Chapter 9. A Startling Event. Some days later, Kebron and Amuba again paid a visit to the temple by moonlight. It was a month since they had been there, for save when the moon was up, the darkness and gloom at the courts was so great that the place offered no attractions. On entering one of the inner courts, they found a massive door in the wall standing ajar. "Where does this lead to?" Amuba asked.
"I do not know," said Kebron. "We will see where it leads to."
Opening it, they saw in front of them a flight of stairs in the thickness of the wall.
"It leads up to the roof," Kebron said in surprise. "I knew not there were stairs to the roof."
"Let us go up, Kebron. It will be curious to look down upon the courts. We need only stay there for a minute or two." After mounting for a considerable distance, they found that the stairs ended in a narrow passage, at the end of which was an opening just wide enough for a man to pass through. Amuba crept out through the opening. Beyond was a ledge a foot wide. Beyond that rose a dome some 6 feet high and 8 or 10 feet along the ledge.
"There is plenty of room for both of us," he said, looking backwards.
At once Kebron joined him.
"Where can we be?"
"There is the sky overhead. We're 20 feet from the top of the wall, and where this ledge ends it seems to go straight down." Kebron looked round him.
"This must be the head of one of the statues. What a curious place. I wonder what it was made for."
Just in front of them was an opening of some 6 inches in diameter in the stone. Amuba pushed his hand down.
"It seems to go a long way down," he said. "Kebron, if this is really the top of the head of one of the great figures, that slit must be where his lips are."
"In that case," Amuba went on,
"this hole must be made to allow the priests to give answers through the mouth of the image to supplications made to it. I have heard that the images sometimes give answers to worshippers. Perhaps this is the secret of it."
Kebron was silent. The idea was a painful one to him, for if this were so, it was evident that trickery was practiced.
"I think we had better go," he said at last. "We have done wrong in coming up here."
"Let me peep over the side first. It seems to me that I can hear voices below." Amuba put his foot in the hole and raised himself sufficiently to get on top of the stone. Leaning forward, he looked over the edge and found himself on the head of the principal idol in the temple. Gathered round the altar at its foot were 7 or 8 men, all of whom he knew by their garments to be priests.
"Come up here, Kebron. There is something important going on."
Kebron joined him, and the two, lying close together, looked down at the court.
"I tell you, we must do away with him,"
one of the group of priests said.
"You know as well as I do that his heart is not in the worship of the gods. He has already shown himself desirous of all sorts of innovations, and unless we take matters in our hands, there is no saying to what lengths he may go. He might shatter the very worship of the gods. Therefore, he must die. If you are ready to undertake the other arrangements, and 2 of you will join me in seeing that the deed is carried out without noise or outcry, I will take the matter in hand."
There was a chorus of approbation from the others, and the speaker went on.
"Leave me to determine the time and place. There is no occasion for haste, and on the 3rd night hence we will again gather here."
Kebron touched Amuba, and the two crept back to where they had been standing on the ledge.
"The villains are planning a murder," Kebron said. "I will give them a fright,"
and applying his mouth to the orifice, he cried,
"Beware, sacrilegious wretches! Your plots shall fail and ruin fall upon you."
"Come on, Kebron," Amuba exclaimed, pulling his garment. "Some of them may know the secret of this statue, and they'll kill us if they find us here."
They groped their way to the top of the stairs and hurried down them as fast as they could in the darkness.
"I hear footsteps," Amuba exclaimed as they issued out from the door. "Run for your life!"
As they left the court, they heard the noise of angry voices and hurried footsteps close by.
"Is there any place where workmen are engaged on the walls?" Amuba asked.
Yes, in the third court on the right after entering.
Then there must be some ladders. Let's make for that court at once. Listen, they're giving the alarm.
The temple now was echoing with sounds, for the priests had all been roused.
Here is the place, Kebron said, stopping at the foot of the wall.
Here two or three long ladders were standing. The top of one could be seen against the skyline.
Mount, Kebron, there's no time to lose.
Kebron mounted, followed closely by his companion. Just as he gained the top of the wall, several men carrying torches ran into the court and began to search along the side lying in shadow.
Keep away from the edge, or it's possible that in this bright moonlight we may be recognized. We must be going on at once. Which way shall we go?
Towards the outer wall as far as possible from the gate. Bring the ladder along. Taking it upon their shoulders, they hurried on. 5 minutes running took them to the outer wall, and the ladder was again lowered, and they descended, and then stood at its foot for a moment to listen.
Let us make straight out and get well away from the temple, and then we will return to your house.
After an hour's walking, they reached home. On the way, they discussed whether or not Kebron should tell Amaris what had taken place, and it was decided to say nothing about the affair unless circumstances occurred which might alter their intentions. They entered the house quietly and reached their apartments without disturbing any of the inmates. The following morning, one of the priests of the temple arrived at an early hour and demanded to see Amaris.
"I have evil tidings to give you, my lord," he said. "Your son, Necho, has this morning been killed."
"Necho? Killed?" Amaris repeated.
"Alas, it is but too true, my lord. It was his turn to offer the sacrifices at dawn. As he did not arrive at the proper time, a messenger was sent to fetch him, and he found him lying dead a few paces from his own door, stabbed to the heart."
Amaris waved his hand to signify that he would be alone, and sat down half stunned by the sudden shock. Between himself and his eldest son there was no great affection. Although Amaris would, in his own house, have gladly relaxed the rigid respect and deference demanded by Egyptian custom on the part of sons towards a father, Necho had never responded to his advances, and had been punctilious in all the observances practiced at that time. He had never taken a seat in his father's presence, had never addressed him unless spoken to, had made his appearance only at stated times to pay his respects to him, and when dismissed had gladly hurried away to the priest who acted as his tutor. As he grew up, the gap had widened instead of closing. Still, the news of Necho's sudden death was a great shock, and Amaris sat without moving for some minutes until a sudden outburst of cries in the house betokened that the messenger had told his tidings to the servants and that these had carried them to their mistress. Amaris at once went to his wife's apartment and endeavored to console her, but wholly without success. Amensi was frantic with grief. Although herself much addicted to the pleasures of the world, the ardor of Necho in the discharge of his religious duties had been a source of pride and gratification to her. Kebron and Maissa bore the news of their brother's death with much more resignation. There had been nothing in common between him and them, and they were more awed by the suddenness and manner of his death than grieved at his loss. When he left them, Amaris went at once to the house of Necho to make further inquiries. There he could learn nothing that could afford any clue. Necho had been late at the temple, and had not returned until long after the rest of the household were in bed, and none had seen him before he left in the morning. No sound of a struggle or cry for help had been heard. His death had apparently been instantaneous. The magistrates, who arrived soon after Amaris to investigate the matter, called the whole of those who could be suspected of harboring ill will against Necho to be brought before them, and questioned as to their doings during the night. All stoutly asserted that they had been in bed at the time of the murder, and nothing occurred to throw a suspicion upon one more than another. As soon as the investigation was concluded, Amaris ordered the corpse to be brought to his own house. Covered by white cloths, it was placed on a sort of sledge, which was drawn by attendants of the temple. Amaris and Kebron followed behind, and after them came a procession of priests. When it arrived at the house, Amense and Maisa, with their hair unbound and falling around them, received the body, uttering loud cries of lamentation, in which they were joined by all the women of the house. The body was carried into an inner apartment, and there, until evening, a loud wailing was kept up. Late in the evening, the body was taken out, placed upon another sledge, and, followed by the male relatives and friends, and by all the attendants and slaves of the house, was carried to the establishment of Kigron the embalmer. During the 40 days occupied by the process, the strictest mourning was observed in the house. At the end of that time, the mummy was brought back in great state, and placed in the room which was in all large Egyptian houses set apart for the reception of the dead. 3 days later, the funeral procession assembled and started from the house. A large number of friends and relations were present. Immediately behind them followed the consecrated boat placed upon a sledge, containing the mummy case in a large exterior case covered with paintings. It was drawn by 4 oxen and 7 men. When they arrived at the sacred lake, the coffin was taken from the small boat in which it had been conveyed and placed in a gorgeously painted boat with a lofty cabin. Amense, Maisa, and Kebron took their places there. It was towed by a large boat with sails and oars. The members of the procession then took their places in other richly decorated sailing boats and all crossed the lake together to the tomb. Here the mummy case was placed on the slab prepared for it, and a sacrifice with libation and incense offered. The door of the tomb was then closed, but not fastened, as sacrificial services would be held there periodically for many years. The procession then returned on foot to the house. During all this time, no certain clue had been obtained as to the authors of the murder. Upon going up to the temple on the day of Necho's death, Kebron found all sorts of rumors current. It was supposed that the affair of the previous night was in some way connected with the death of Necho. Upon Kebron's return with his news, he and Amuba agreed that it was necessary to inform Amaris at once of their doings on the previous night. After the evening meal was over, Amaris called Kebron into his study.
"Have you heard aught in the temple, Kebron, as to this strange affair that took place there last night? I cannot see how it can have any connection with your brother's death. Yet still, it is strange. Have you heard who first discovered these thieves last night? Some say that it was Tylus, though what he should be doing there at that hour I know not. 4 or 5 others are named by priests as having aroused them, but curiously not one of these is in the temple today. I have received a letter from Tylus, saying that he has been suddenly called to visit some relations, living on the seashore near the mouths of the Nile. The others sent similar excuses. This is most strange, for none notified me yesterday that they had occasion to be absent. Have you heard anything that would seem to throw any light upon the subject?"
"I have heard nothing, Father, but I can tell you much. I should have spoken to you the first thing this morning had it not been for the news about Necho." Kebron then related to Amaris how he and Amuba had the night before visited the temple and overheard the plot to murder some unknown person.
"This is an extraordinary tale, Kebron," Amaris said, when he had brought his story to a conclusion. "You certainly would have been slain had you been overtaken. How the door that led to the staircase came to be open, I cannot imagine. The place is only used on very rare occasions, when it is deemed absolutely necessary that we should influence in one direction or another the course of events. As to this conspiracy you say you overheard, it is much more serious. The sudden absence of Tylus and the others would seem to show that they were conscious of guilt. Against whom their plot was directed, I can form no idea."
"You do not think, Father," Kebron said hesitatingly, "that the plot could have been to murder Necho?"
"I do not think so. Knowing that they were overheard last night, they would assuredly not have carried the plan into execution. Besides which, as you say, no plan was arrived at. And after the whole temple was disturbed, they would hardly have met afterwards and arranged this fresh scheme of murder.
Now the whole affair is a terrible mystery. At any rate, no doubt the plot, against whomsoever it was directed, will be abandoned, for they will never be sure as to how much is known, and whether those who overheard them may not be waiting for the commission of the crime to denounce them. In the meantime, you will on no account renew your visit to the temple, or enter it at any time, except when called upon to do so by your duties. The very day after Necho's funeral, Maissa and her mother were thrown into a flutter of excitement by a message which arrived from Bubastes. Some months before, the sacred cat of the great temple there had fallen sick and had died. The task of finding its successor was an important and arduous one. It was necessary not only that the cat should be distinguished for its size and beauty, but that it should bear certain markings. Therefore, as soon as the cat was dead, a party of priests set out from Bubastes to visit all the cities of Egypt in search of its successor. As soon as one of the parties of the priests had reached Thebes, Amensi had sent to them a description of Maissa's great cat, Pausis, inviting them to call and visit her and inspect the cat. Amensi received them with much honor, presented Maissa to them as the owner of the cat, and accompanied the priests in their visit to the home of Maissa's pets. Their report was most favorable. They had, since they left Bubastes, seen no cat approaching Pausis in size and beauty, and although her markings were not precisely correct, they approximated very closely to the standard. They could say no more than this, because the decision could not be made until the return of all the parties of searchers to Bubastes. A week after the funeral of Necho, a message arrived saying that the report concerning Pausis was so much more favorable than any others, it had been decided by the high priest that Pausis alone was worthy of the honor. The messenger stated that in a fortnight a deputation would set out from Bubastes in order to receive the sacred cat and to conduct her with all due ceremony to the shrine of Bubastes. Maissa was delighted at the honor which had befallen her cat, while Amensi was vastly gratified at the news. It was considered the highest honor that could befall an Egyptian for one of his animals to be chosen to fill the chief post in one of the temples, especially the sacred cat of the great goddess Bubastes. As soon as the news was known, all the friends and acquaintances of the family flocked in to offer their congratulations, and so many visits were paid to Maissa's enclosure that even the tranquillity of Pausis was disturbed by the succession of admirers. Amensi, declaring that she felt responsible for the animal being in perfect health when the priests arrived for it, permitted only the callers whom she particularly desired to honor to pay a visit of inspection to it.